It's TV review time, and first up, Apple TV take us to the heart of Hollywood with the satirical comedy The Studio. Seth Rogen is Matt Remick, the film fanatic who works at Continental Studios and dreams of running it. But when he gets the job, it quickly turns into a nightmare and he struggles to save a company and his reputation. Next, after the success of his Netflix series, The Gentleman, Guy Ritchie is back and sticking to what he knows best. Mobland from Paramount Plus is his latest series about two warring crime families who clash in a battle that threatens to topple their empires. Pierce Brosnan stars as the charismatic but ruthless patriarch Conrad Harrigan, and Tom Hardy plays his fixer. And finally, this evening, we are staying in the criminal underworld, but this time we're in Liverpool with the BBC drama This City Is Ours. The series follows Michael Kavanagh, who has been involved in organised crime his entire life. But like his boss, Ronnie Phelan, he wants to retire and enjoy a different future. Sean Bean stars as Ronnie Phelan and James Nelson Joyce stars as Michael Kavanagh as boss and fixer. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have been watching all three and join me now in studio. And we will start with The Studio, Chris. It begins where it's a satirical comedy about TV and TV now and what executives want to put on and what maybe somebody who has romantic notions about running a studio, what problems they run into.
Yeah, that's right. And it's also about a man who loves movies. His whole life is movies. Matt Remick, played by Seth Rogen, who co-creates, co-writes, co-directs and stars, he's always had this, you know, dream job in his head to run his own studio. But I don't think he realizes that once he gets that dream job, it's actually going to be a nightmare to deal with. So we meet him at a stage in his career where he has been an executive at Continental Studios, fictional studios, something like, you know, like a Universal or a Paramount. He's been with them for 20 odd years, and one morning he gets word that the head of the studio, Paddy Lay, played by Catherine O'Hara, brilliant in this, she has been sacked, and Griffin Mill, played by Bryan Cranston, he wants to meet with Matt, and so Matt thinks, I'm going to get the top job here. He does, and Matt genuinely believes for 5 minutes or so that he'd be able to improve the industry, because the industry is kind of screwed. I mean, it's all about the bottom line. It's not about the quality of the filmmaking anymore. It's just, especially in light of a Warner's success with Barbie, which Griffin Mill is obsessed with, it's all about who has the best IP and who can make the most money.
And Seth Rogen's character is a fanatic, and he watches Goodfellas every night. Like, he really
He's obsessed.
Films, yes.
And he wants to preserve the integrity of filmmaking. He still believes that, you know, there's an awful lot that can be done with it. It's not about, you know, but the bottom line, it's not about box office figures. Unfortunately, again, he's only just in the job when he's told, find the next IP. Well, actually, the IP is found for him. His boss essentially wants him to make a film about the Kool-Aid Man. And for anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's basically an animated mascot for a soft drink. So it's an impossible task for a guy who really loves films.
Okay, well, let's go before he gets the job. Following the sacking of his boss, Matt is summoned to meet the head of the studio, Griffin Mill, and to pitch for the job. Seth plays Matt here, and Bryan Cranston is Griffin, and there is some bad language.
Film is my life. Ever since I came to the studio as a kid and went on the tour, being the head of Continental is the only job I've ever wanted.
That is adorable. All right, well, listen, I honestly just have one strong reservation about you.
Oh.
I've heard you are really into artsy-fartsy filmmaking bullshit. You're obsessed with actors and directors liking you rather than being obsessed with making this studio as much money as possible.
Me?
Yeah.
That could not be further from the truth. I am as bottom-line oriented as anyone in this town.
I believe you.
Great.
Good.
Good.
Because at Continental, we don't make films. We make movies. Mm-hmm. Movies that people want to pay to see.
Yes.
Come here. I got a little secret for you. Not for anyone else to hear this, but I am very close to closing on the deal to get the rights to Kool-Aid. And I'm talking a huge four-quadrant version of it.
Kool-Aid.
Kool-Aid.
The red drink?
Yeah.
The guy who breaks through walls and says, oh yeah?
Yes.
That is fucking perfect. Oh, that's exactly what we should be doing, Mr. Mill.
Finally, someone who gets it.
Oh, I get it.
Oh, my God.
So he's sold his soul even before he's got the job. That's Seth Rogen there. Jen, Seth Rogen had a very illustrious career in comedy in the noughties, and then he went through a rather dry patch. Is this a good vehicle for his talents?
I think we were just literally talking about this outside that, you know, Seth Rogen has become this kind of person who's, you know, unafraid to say things these days about the way Hollywood is run and how he's unhappy with the choices that are made about blockbusters, etc. So he kind of has stepped back a bit and put his neck on the line a bit and is happy to live his life doing smaller roles and doing a lot of pottery. He loves making his own pottery and like basically being a solid guy, that an all-rounder, and you can see why he wants to make something like this. And you can see how a lot of people want to get involved in this. Like, there is this like roster of who you had in every episode is a massive who's who.
Yes,
of
tell us
Hollywood
a little
players.
About the people who are in it. Sometimes playing themselves, and then sometimes playing somebody slightly
a
disguised
of
themselves.
Yeah, but like a little known person called Martin Scorsese in episode one. I mean, it's incredible. Like a director, Sarah Polley, Greta Lee, the actress. Then you have someone like Olivia Wilde and someone like Ron Howard as well. And they're all willing to kind of send up this version of themselves and inflated egos, or the heartbreak that you go through to get something on screen, that toughness, that you, the tenacity that you have to succeed in Hollywood, and how people like Remick's character, they're the ones that put the roadblocks in place and things, you know, fall apart or they go askew and you end up, you know, getting a film made that is about like it's IP like the Kool-Aid Man, which is ridiculous.
It's a series, isn't it, Chris, that's in love with filmmaking. The long shot, the one shot, which was made famous in The Player, which was a nod previously to A Touch of Evil, is actually done in episode two, I think.
Yeah, the Sarah Polley episode.
And while before they do it, they're watching the one shot in Goodfellas. So yeah, there's all these things, as Jen talked about, all the famous people who are in it. Everything for people who love film to enjoy.
Absolutely. But also, you know, it's not just for film buffs. There are an awful lot of in-jokes in there. But I think even if you don't know your films, you will find an awful lot to laugh at and to love here too. That second episode, I thought, is ingeniously plotted and so well acted. And it is about Sarah Polley trying to master this one shot with Greta Lee. And, you know, Matt Remick, who is obviously the studio head at this point, is visiting the set and it all goes wrong. But the episode itself was done in a single take. So it's all very well pieced together. And it's made by people who genuinely love film, and it's about people who love film. And as you said, they have people like Matt Remick, his best friend Sal, played by Ike Barinholtz, and it, you know, Matt's whole team. They have sold their soul, but they haven't traded in all of their ideals. They do, you know, there is a part of them that thinks they are doing something, even just a small bit, to try and make the industry better. And I think this is the kind of show that last year we reviewed The Franchise by Armando Iannucci, which was another attempt at, you know, this big studio Hollywood satire. But with The Franchise, you had a show about people who hated their jobs and who hated films and who hated themselves. And it was all very bleak and it had no real charm. But this is about people who still love Hollywood, and it's made by people who love it. And I think that really shows there's an energy, there's a lightness, there's a wit, and there's a big charm about it.
And
too.
Also there's a beauty to it. I have to say, it looks stunning.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks stunning. Like, the visual style is very evocative of those films that Remick worships. So you have everything from this kind of mid-60s aesthetic up to the 70s. Where, like, you could say it looks like it is from the 70s because you have the style. It's all like beige and taupe and bronze kind of colours, beautiful lighting. And then it also kind of has a nod to the later kind of 80s films that he would have been obsessed with as well, like a bit of Michael Mann in there as well. So there's a lot, like, the beauty radiates from the screen. You know that it is made by people who genuinely love film and have a real interest in film and preserving it.
But from the thesis that's set up in the first thing about this executive selling his soul to get the job and then making all the films that he was totally against, these commercial product, then you say that it gets quite episodic.
It, for me, what the problem was, I think, like, there's, as we were saying, like something like The Franchise maybe didn't work, but there is other shows that lampoon the entertainment industry, like The Other Two, which I think is, I always mention it is fantastic, or even something like Call My Agent and or Barry, and they skewer it in such a way where, you know, it's a dagger to the heart, whereas I think they go far but they don't go far enough here. It's a bit like, you know, rather rather than a dagger to the heart, I said it was like a butter knife into a donut. Like, it doesn't feel as sharp as it could be. And that's what good satire is. It has to have take aim. But I think they're in love with their subjects too much. They're in love with Hollywood too much to really do that. And I also think I have a Seth Rogen problem in the way of what happens is there is this overarching story about, you know, what is it when art and commerce meet each other or go against each other and how do we fix this problem? But then it kind of devolves into it's just a bit of a slapstick sitcom where, you know, in every episode you nearly have Seth Rogen just shouting like the Cookie Monster and then falling over. Mm-hmm. And I don't think
Chris,
that
what did you
makes
think?
Good comedy.
I don't know. I have a soft spot for Seth Rogen. Whenever he falls over, I do laugh. There is a lot of him falling over in this, but the physical comedy is very well done. I thought it worked brilliantly as a Hollywood satire and also as a cringe comedy, a workplace farce. And I like that the talent that's lining around the block to be in this thing. That kind of told me that Seth Rogen and his creative partner Evan Goldberg, who is co-directing this with him, that kind of tells me that, you know, they are touching on something that, you know, that they are offering a more truthful depiction of the industry than I think people would care to admit.
But also, did you not think that was a bit cozy then? There's something, it is a love-in, like it is a complete love-in.
It can get a bit cozy at times, but I still like the fact that they are making this. I like the fact that he is doing something like this because this could hurt somebody's career, like saying these things about the industry, but I'm glad that he's doing it.
It could to a level, but I don't think anybody in it is going to be upset, like as in, like, I don't think their jobs are on the
line. Nobody's going to lose any jobs. No.
No. I think Martin Scorsese.
I think he's okay.
Marty's all right.
Marty's
safe. Yeah, okay.
So stars out of 5 from you for the studios, Chris.
Oh, I loved it. I haven't
given it the
full number. I haven't had this much fun with a television show in a while, so more please, 5 stars.
I don't think it's a laugh-a-minute masterpiece, but I think it's very well done and it's beautiful and it's fun to watch. I think it's like film bros nostalgia is where this is at for me, and it's 3.5.
3.5, okay. Now, God, did we ever think there were so many gangs in London? We knew it was a dangerous place, but we have one from London and one from Liverpool. Let's go to the London one first. Jen, this is Mobland, directed by Guy Ritchie, and it stars Pierce Brosnan as Conrad Harrigan, the patriarch of an Irish crime gang. Can you set it up for us?
But also, just to say, the screenwriter is Ronan Bennett, who we were talking about earlier this year with, you know, the Day of the Jackal revival. He was responsible for that and Top Boy. And then you have acclaimed playwright Jez Butterworth is also involved in this. Mm. So there feels like this certain kind of calibre to it. But I can, just from the get-go, because it's revolving around this Irish family, we have to say this is a very, like, is an Ireland cool kind of show that we have, like, has probably kicked off since Normal People, because even the theme tune is Fontaine's Starburster, which is was huge to me. And I think that may be the responsibility of Matt Bellamy from Muse, who's also doing their music, you know, he's their music supervisor. So they're banking on a big audience here from like minute one, second one. So Tom Hardy is the lead here, and he's Harry D'Souza, and he's a fixer for the Harrigan family. And they're in the middle of this very dangerous situation where the son of a rival crime boss, Richie Stevenson, has gone missing, and he's last seen alive with the grandson of the Harrigan crime boss. So the tensions are rising between these two families, and there is a war is threatened.
Okay, let's hear a clip from it. Tom Hardy, as you say, is the fixer for the Pierce Brosnan character. So he goes to him, and because they want to discuss the outcome of Harry's meeting with the two rival families, and he wants to get some direction from Pierce Brosnan.
Where are we? They've agreed to shake hands. No apologies.
No.
Well, what does your gut tell you?
Honestly? Oh, it's a bit of a sticky plaster, isn't it? Last maybe 5-6 months at best. Then it'll all kick off and we'll be back where we started. Maybe worse.
My source inside the Dohams tells me that Mehmet has been skimming off the top. And it's a damn sight more than 2 or 3 grand here and there. And it turns out that Costas has been a naughty boy too. It's always the same in any orchard. You plant the trees grow tall. Then sooner or later, they begin to get mangled. And before you know it, the apples start to rot. And that, Harry, my son, is pruning time.
So Harry can read him perfectly, and he goes in and prunes some of the bad guys for the Pierce Brosnan character. We have to talk about Pierce's accent. Pierce is, we know from Navin, but I'm delighted in this. It's quite a Munster accent he has. Yeah. A little bit of Cork, bit of Limerick.
It's a little Tipperary. Bit of everything. I just think it takes a scene crew to nowhere. there's a little bit of a Tipperary, a bit of everything, a bit of Squire from The Quiet Man at one point as well, which is not a compliment.
A bit of Taffin.
Yeah, this always happens whenever Pierce Brosnan plays an Irishman, whether it's Taffin or in Evelyn or in The Outlaws, The Foreigner. It just goes so wrong. And I think maybe the part of the blame should be shared by the dialect coach, because there's so much, and also there's so much Irish talent in this. You've got Emma J. Scanlon, you've got Lisa Dwan, you've got Guy Ritchie, who's where he's not Irish himself, but he's worked with so many Irish performers.
He thinks he's Irish.
You think someone would have said, Pierce, this is not good enough. And it's a shame, because that accent, and also Helen Mirren's accent in it, they're so distracting.
Helen Mirren plays his wife.
Helen Mirren plays his wife, Maeve. Yeah. And the accents are so, they're just such a distraction that they take away from the performance, because that's the opening scene from the first episode. And at that point, where most of it was whispered, you kind of think to yourself, Pierce Brosnan's quite sinister here, and he's going to be quite effective as his crime boss.
Is that just the Irish thing, Jen, of always getting caught up on people's accents? I know Pierce Brosnan is Irish, but I mean, I could kind of get away with it
because he has so much charisma about him, and there is this very lyrical romanticism to his character as Conrad, and you're not supposed to be able to read him. You don't know, you know, what humour he's going to be in, and is he going to be in this kind of, I'm giving you, you know, wisdom and riddles, or am I going to just attack you? So, I mean, that plays into it, and I think he's good at that, I do. But Helen Mirren sometimes sounds like she's in a fantasy show.
She plays a kind of Lady Macbeth.
Lady Macbeth, I was calling her.
Always poking her husband to do the more evil choice.
Completely, but she also sounds like she came from Jamaica as well at times, and that can be difficult to bear. When the two of them are in scenes together, it is jarring on the ears, I will say, which is upsetting because it's Helen Mirren, and you want to be able to enjoy that performance. But everybody here is acting at a 20. It's very oversized, and the person that saves this is Tom Hardy.
Yeah, Tom Hardy has transformed himself back into Tom Hardy. After so many years of unable to understand what he's saying.
He is completely dialing everything down, being completely understated, so believable, really magnetic, and it's such an impressive lead performance from him, I think. And it's, you know, it doesn't overshadow whatever everybody else is doing, because he has this great subtlety to him here. And if it was more focused, it is focused on him, but I think he kind of pulls it together and moves it away from the circus of the Harrigan family. And when you're watching him, it feels like you're actually watching a different show.
Yes, he's Harry D'Souza, and he has to really go and do all the dirty work.
Yeah.
So in a series that's crowded with other characters, he really is the central character.
He's the kind of heart of it. Yeah, he's the beating heart of this, and he's the only real believable character too. And even his personal life is fascinating, because his marriage is crumbling, his marriage to Jan, played by Joanne Froggatt, and he's just trying to hold everything together. He's working for the Harrigans, but at times it seems like he's working for the Stevenses too. And it's a lovely performance, and it's a performance that clearly he's put time and effort into. And I don't think the show runners themselves have put that time into, because I'm fascinated by the story that, very long story short, that this was actually developed as a prequel spin-off to Ray Donovan, an award-winning crime drama about a fixer, played by Lee Schreiber. And this was supposed to be called The Donovans. It was in development for a year or two. Last year, last November, it was announced that this would be its own thing. It would fly its own flag. It would tell its own tale. It would be a standalone series. They shot it before Christmas, and now it's been packaged and edited and distributed in time for a March release. That is way too quick. Like, that's an extraordinarily quick turnaround, even by today's speedy standards.
It's
a show that's been assembled in a hurry, and it looks that way.
Yeah, I did find when I was watching it, I was wondering which bit was Jess Butterworth, which bit was Ronan Bennett, which bit was Guy Ritchie.
I think you can tell the Guy Ritchie scenes, because they're all the ones in the club. They're all the ones that have, you know, a soundtrack by Prodigy all the time. You know, the fast cuts are anything to do with, like, you're in a car and a guy's being run off the road with a motorbike. Like, that's Guy Ritchie all over. And the bits that are kind of more quote-unquote humorous, Guy Ritchie's never funny, first of all, I have to say that. And you need somebody to come in, an actual comedy writer, to punch up the dialogue, because the dialogue, when it tries to be funny, it fails. It falls flat on its face, and it is quite rote, so it needs something extra to pump it up. And the pump it up, what Guy Ritchie thinks is pumping it up, is visually, you know, twisty, turny, quick cuts, all those shots that you're so familiar with from Lock, Stock and Snatch. But that highly stylized also kind of takes away from the story, so I think that he's kind of distracting you at the same time.
Okay, stars out of five from you for Mobland.
I think there's some dodgy acting, and I will always single out Anson Boone. I think he's terrible as the son Eddie. It's the Hollyoaks school of acting. He's like Rick Mayall in The Young Ones, and I don't think he actually intentionally means to be like that, but he's very annoying, and I did want him to be killed in one of the first episodes, but he's not. But I do think we have to delve into masculinity a little bit deeper than we're getting in a lot of our mobster shows. So for me, it'd be a 2.5.
2.5. And from you, Chris?
Oh, it's Ritchie all over. It's low stakes Mickey Mouse gangster affair, like, and it's just not good enough. Great stuff from Tom Hardy. I really do like him in it, but it's an awful waste to have him play such a good character in a show that's not good enough for him. So 2 stars.
2 stars. OK, well, let's move up the motorway to Liverpool. And Chris, here we are with the BBC drama This City Is Ours. And we're in Mobland again, but this time in Liverpool. We don't have Pierce Brosnan this time. We have Sean Bean.
Yeah, we've Sean Bean, but the two of them got to be in a Bond film together. So now they're playing gangsters in very different shows. This is a little bit more authentic and certainly more grounded than Mobland. And it tells of a Sheffield gangster in Liverpool named Ronnie Phelan, who is sort of coming to the end of his tenure as this the head of an empire that's kind of controlled the drug trade in Liverpool for decades. And he's sort of considering retiring. And if he does that, if he moves off to Spain with his wife, Elaine, played by Julie Graham, he might leave his empire in the hands of Michael, who's been by his side for 20 years, played by James Nelson Joyce. But before he does that, he just wants to make enough money to kind of secure that retirement. So that involves doing this extraordinarily lucrative cocaine shipment with the Colombian cartel. Unfortunately, when the shipment comes in, it actually disappears. And so Ronnie starts asking himself, well, who in the gang kind of knew about this coming in? And nobody outside the gang did. So it very clearly is a rat inside the organization.
Yes.
But as well as that, we're kind of delving into the lives of all of Ronnie's henchmen, especially Michael, who is in his late 30s, starting to kind of believe that there might be more to life than all of this shady gangster affair. And he's trying to start a family through IVF with his partner, Diana. So it sort of delves into, you know, Ronnie's business, that of his henchmen, but also the focus is on Michael too.
So Jen, is it more successful, did you think, than Mobland?
Does that all sound familiar to you? Because to me, it sounds like a sub-Godfather. We have to get control of the psychological hold that the Godfather and Scarface has had on men of a certain age and who get things commissioned and who write this kind of stuff. Because
but Michael, the
again.
Fixer, has a sensitivity. He's worried about his sperm count.
Michael Corleone, anybody? Because this is what is happening, because he is stuck in the middle of this moral, psychological dilemma of, do I want to keep on going? Can I face the violence and viciousness of the work that I'm doing? Or do I want to break free and be with the woman I love? Or do I want to even bring a child into this awful world? And this woman is from a different stratosphere of society. She's not from a gangster family. Will she understand? It's all stuff we've seen before. And what it is, you know, recently we've seen before with Kin. And it's very much, I think it's like the UK answer to Kin. And if you, it's literally almost the same in certain instances, I think, with the family, like this whole thing of doing things for the family that reaches right back to The Godfather. But it's just obviously not as good as The Godfather.
So we've seen it all before, Chris, but is it well done what they do?
It's a little sluggish. It comes with an impeccable cast. I mean, once you see Sean Bean's name in the cast sheet, you know, I'm in.
And he stuck to his own
happy with that. I just think, look, we can't expect gangland dramas like this to reinvent the wheel. They're all going to, you know, borrow and nick from one another, and that's fine. But I think that the least we should expect is for it to try and have some sort of identity or personality of its own, or to just even make some sort of attempt to not just be a Scouse Love Hate or a Scouse Kin or even a Scouse Sopranos. Maybe comparing it to the Sopranos is a bit much.
That's a stretch.
Yeah, it is a stretch. So I'm not really seeing much of an identity, but I do like the characters, though. I think Nelson Joyce in particular, playing the Michael character, he performs that very impressive gangster telly trick where he makes you root for him in a way. He makes you like him despite the fact that we see him do terrible things and we know that he's not that great of a person. We still don't want to see him go down. And also, with Sean being on board, he is terrific here. I do hope he makes it to the end of the series. But at the same time, he does play this because he's not well looking from the start, and he does seem as though he's maybe one bad conversation from
because
just
another Game of Thrones.
I'm worried about that.
How many Sean Bean deaths have we had in far so many, too many shows?
But he is quite watchable, and I think he elevates this. There's some good Irish talent in there as well. Saoirse Monica Jackson is in there too. There's a wonderful scene in there where Saoirse Monica Jackson's character, she plays Cheryl, who is married to one of the gangsters, Davey, played by Stephen Walters, and she has this wonderful scene with Diana, and this could be they could have delved further into this.
Diana is Michael's
partner, where she's telling her, look, you guys have only been together a year and a half, you're kind of new here by that count, get out while you can. And that is a fascinating story that I don't think
this is what I mean, because like if you're doing a cliche, when you do cliche gangster dramas, the women do get forgotten about because they're and in this it's like that too, because they're either hapless molls or they're tough broads, and Saoirse Monica Jackson's role is the only character I cared about because you can see that she is unhinged and she could fly off at any moment because she's tired of this ugliness and everything she's seen, and she is damaged, and there's potential for her within the show to grow, but they don't really give it enough space or time, I think, and that's a real disappointment, and that just shows the problem with certain screenwriters when they're beholden to those cliches that they can't break free of. And I think we need something like The Sopranos to come along again to examine, if you want to do it through a gangster lens, to examine masculinity in a different way, and this doesn't, it's not bothered, it doesn't seem to care about those characters in that way. And I think we just have to get over the world of coke and guns and bravado and, you know, misogyny. We can, you know, use them as tools to say something different, but this isn't saying anything different at all.
So, stars out of 5 from you, Jen. I am not expecting a lot.
2 for this. I'll give Guy Ritchie the half. I can't believe him. I'm giving him the half. That was for Tom Hardy, though, but this is a 2.
I'm not giving it the same star rating as Mobland. Not when it has Sean Bean in it. I didn't hate it. It is watchable, but there are some serious problems with the storytelling and also the pacing. So we'll go with 3.
3. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you very much. The Studio is on Apple TV. Mobland is on Paramount Plus. And This City Is Ours continues on BBC. Now it's time for our album reviews, and this week we review Mumford & Sons, the folk rock band that redefined the genre with their breakout album Sigh No More. They continued their evolution with a sound that has moved away from the banjo-driven ballads to stadium-sized anthems. Their latest album is called Rushmere, named after a pond in Wimbledon that recalls the band's roots. The Darkness, the British glam rockers behind Permission to Land, and the enduring hit I Believe in a Thing Called Love return with another collection of high-energy, tongue-in-cheek rock on their album called Dreams on Toast. And finally, Alison Krauss, a bluegrass and country icon with 27 Grammy wins to her name, delivers an album called Arcadia that showcases her signature delicate vocals and musicianship. I'm joined by Pat Carty and Nadine O'Regan. Let's start with Mumford & Sons, and this is a track called Truth.
When I look into your eyes, I feel further every time. But I see the roots that take, put a shiver down my spine. I came here asking nothing, but I'm leaving with a list. I was born to believe the truth is all there to go.
That was Truth from Rushmere, the new album from Mumford & Sons. And as I said, Pat Carty and Nadine O'Regan are here. Nadine, it takes us back to Rushmere, which is a pond in Wimbledon, which is where the band started off, really.
Mm, Yes, I mean, it is a return to their roots, I suppose. And, you know, they were so successful that when they first emerged back in around, 2009, and I recall, actually, I think it was at Oxygen, I wandered into a tent, and at the time, they weren't that known an entity, and I just saw this band performing, and the fans were absolutely ecstatic. There was a real movement around that time. Folk artists like Laura Marling would have been another artist who was part of this sort of new folk British movement, which seemed a little odd as well, because Mumford & Sons were formed in London, and there was it was no secret. They were all very well-to-do young men. I actually interviewed them back at their record company offices in 2009 as well, and it was immediately apparent that they were very much treated with sort of, you know, they were afforded great privileges. It felt like I was already interviewing band members who were celebrities, even though they were just in and around their debut album at that point. But they became extraordinarily successful with songs like Little Lion Man, and went on to win a stack of awards, both in Britain and also in the US. So over the intervening years, their fortunes have wavered somewhat. One band member has left. Marcus Mumford recorded a solo album, which got sort of uneven reviews. And now they're back to their roots, doing what Mumford do, or hoping to do what Mumford do, as well as they did once before.
Yes, you called them folky toffs, I think, Pat.
I did, yeah. I'm not going to be as polite as Nadine at all. There's something about this crowd there. I was at that gig as well, I think, the one that Nadine is talking about. And at the same festival, there was a young fella in the campsite with an acoustic guitar who played that Little Lion Man, I think that's the name of it, over and over again. So I've hated them with a passion ever since then. Absolutely
oh,
have.
Yeah, you said you weren't being subtle. I didn't realise how unsubtle.
Yeah, I'm going to be fair. I mean, the member that you mentioned that left, I mean, that put a serious cloud over them. That was Winston Marshall, and he left because he praised some right-wing literature. And I don't know whether he left of his own accord or he was turfed out the door. I suspect it might have been the latter. So, yeah, they're down to a three-piece now with this Rushmere. And as you say, it's a bit. It seems to be a bit of a step back to where they came from, that kind of folky stomp thing. You know, when people get out the acoustic guitars and some fella has to be sitting on a box and hitting it with his hand. There's some Spanish word for that box, you know, that where people try to convince you it's a real instrument. But that song that you played there, I was speaking to Ollie on your production team just before we came on, and he said that reminded him of Ocean's 11 or something, where Brad Pitt is planning a caper or something like that. It's not terrible. It's not bad. I am prejudiced against this band, and I'm sorry about that. But I mean, this is not a terrible record or anything like that. But it's a bit kind of, you know.
So it's not terrible. I think you have reservations about it, Nadine, but I think you see more of an evenness and an okayness about it.
It's, you know, incredibly coherent track to track. There's a synchronicity there. The band members are very in tune with each other. You can tell this is the sound of a band who are listening to each other very well. And actually, one thing you really do have to say about them is they know their instruments. They know what they're trying to achieve. Marcus Mumford's vocal is very strong. There's an easy confidence there. The album flows really nicely. And the song you just played, Truth, I mean, I think that's a highlight. I also really liked Where It Belongs. There's a churchy feel off aspects of this record as well that sort of needs to be said. I mean, some of these tracks could be reconfigured as sort of quasi-spirituals, and I think that they would work really, really well, even though Mumford & Sons don't define themselves as a religious band, although there is definitely a spiritual aspect there. I think Marcus Mumford was raised in quite a spiritual household, if you like. But, you know, is it a little mundane at times? Probably. But is it incredibly well made? Yes.
So David Cobb is the producer, and he insisted that they open the album with this track called Malibu.
Yeah, I think it's fair enough. The album gets more bombastic at times. There are moments where, you know, the heady days are recalled. There are tracks where they feel a bit like a retread of Little Lion Man. But ultimately, there is a sort of a comforting kind of weariness to a lot of this record, where you can feel yourself thinking, oh yeah, you know, I'll just, you know, put on the Mumford album and sort of pad about the kitchen. And, you know, whether or not that's a good thing, I guess it depends what your
Paint
particular
praise, I think, is what I'm noting down here.
It's well done.
I feel they're not going to get better at the other side of the table.
No, sorry. I was lost in reverie there, thinking about how much I love this band. That song that you played there, it breaks out into a huge big chorus that their legion of fans will enjoy in stadiums and arenas across the world this summer. And that's what it's about. They're kind of a folky Coldplay, you know, and if that's your bag, cool. My partner, who I have to say is a woman of incredibly good taste, thinks this band are fabulous. So I've been warned not to say too much about them. It's fine. It's grand.
Well, you've behaved.
It's like the colour of this table. It's beige, you know.
Stars out of 5 from you, Pat.
2.5. I will sit exactly on the middle of the fence.
From you, Nadine.
3
and 2.5 for Rushmere by Mumford and Sons. So, The Darkness. Pat, you are our living expert on The Darkness. Tell us, Dreams on Toast is the name of the album, but you know this band intimately.
You're going to sing, aren't you?
I'm going to sing it, yeah. I'm actually thanked for my continued inspiration on the cover, on the inner cover of this album. I know this band personally. I've done some stuff with them. They had a box set last year. I did the sleeve notes for it. But can I give it a fair shake? Can I give it a fair review? Can I be professional about it? Yes, I can. I think this is great.
Judge and jury on yourself. Yeah, good
they,
man.
They have. I like this record. I mean, I think it's grown up rock. There is a kind of perception of The Darkness as a bit of a joke band, at least there was for years. But they're deadly serious. This is a good record. It's got country influences, which people wouldn't seen. Justin Hawkins raps at one point, which you can take either way. And there's a great lyrical kind of
picked a song that shows his falsetto. So this is I Hate Myself. It's really hard not to bop to that. That's I Hate Myself from Dreams on Toast by The Darkness. You said, Nadine, the only thing that would define this album as a success was the amount of bangers. Were you happy?
That's
a banger, isn't it?
That one that made me smile, and it made me think of Nights Out in Bruxelles. If there was ever a Bruxelles band, that would be The Darkness. The Darkness, they always bring a smile to my lips. And I kind of think of them as a band that are very much in love with music. They're in love with the likes of AC/DC. They're in love with the lycra clad guitar music of the past, and they're deeply knowledgeable about those different bands. And actually, one of the things that I really enjoyed about this record are these really unusual segues that they manage within the space of actually quite short tracks, where they go down different roads where you think, oh, that's AC/DC, or that's actually a bit like Elton John, or whoa, I wasn't expecting that. And then the lyrics just make me laugh. Like on I Hate Myself, there's a line, I'm a rock and roll party cowboy and I ain't gonna read no Tolstoy. He's just like, whatever, you know. And then Walking Through Fire, Justin Hawkins sings, we're only doing this because it's fun. Don't think my mom bought the last one. And, you know, there's this sense of fun permeating it. And when they first emerged with, was it Permission to Land? I liked them at the time. I loved I Believe in a Thing Called Love. I think I drove people crazy playing that track. And Taylor Swift actually was caught on camera at the US Open, sing along to that song. And you know, you sort of think to yourself, yeah, of course she's going to sing along to that song because it is a banger. So do they have bangers on this album? They've come very close with some very good songs that I think will sound very, very well live. So as a record, you know, it can get a bit wearing because it's a bit uniform in parts because of what they're trying
to
do.
You're upsetting him now.
I know. But because they've always got this little sort of sardonic quality to them, it makes me step back a little bit. I can't get lost in the music. I think of them as a comedy spectacle quite a lot, more than I really want to.
Yes.
I still admire them.
Pat, you know Justin Hawkins. Is he in it for the fun or is he deadly serious?
I think equally both. How about that? When you say that he rhymed cowboy with Tolstoy, in a line further on, he rhymed it with bok choy. So I said in a review that he's definitely stumbled past the library, but maybe he was on his way to a Chinese restaurant at the time. He is serious as a hole in a boat. He really is. I mean, and as Nadine says, he's a studied historian of this kind of rock music. and he's brilliant at it, but he's a great songwriter. The rock and roll party cowboy, which is, it's playing with those tropes, I think, of hard rock, because the guy in it, you know, is looking for the party and where the girl's at. But then by the end of the song, he's talking about a lot about his pool boy that's in his employ, you know. So there's a few things going on there. It's based on a Dutch drug dealer, actually, strangely enough, who talks with that kind of accent. And
where would you get such insight?
There you go. And Walking Through Fire. I mean, I think that's one of the central songs on it. And that, you know, what you said, I think my mum didn't even buy the last record and he's tired of making videos and all that. But he gets to the chorus. And there's a scream out that I can't help falling in love with rock and roll, you know. So he's in it for the real reasons, I think.
And they're playing Wembley, you know. I mean, they're doing really well. They've made quite the comeback.
So, yeah.
Let's listen to Walking Through Fire. I'm a precious day, that's Walking Through Fire from Dreams on Toast by The Darkness. So overall, and stars out of 5 from you, Nadine.
So 3 for the album, but if I were to hear it in a live setting, it would be a 4 because I think it would be absolutely wonderful live. I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Pat.
Well, I have to be fair and balanced here. So can I give it 10 out of 5 or something like that? A very strong 4 out of 5. I think this is a great record and I think they're a great band. But, you know, contractually obliged to say that.
Well, thank you very much for that. Let's move on now to Arcadia, Alison Krauss and Union Station. Nadine, I mean, she has such a terrific career.
Yes.
27 Grammys, worked with Robert Plant. She was on Arena talking with Robert Plant about their working together. Mm. And now she's back with her band Union Station.
Yeah, and it's incredible to think. I mean, she was the singer and female artist with the most awards in Grammy history until Beyonce won her 28th Grammy in 2021. And when you think about that, I mean, what a low-key artist to be in that position. And actually, all of the band members are similarly garlanded. I mean, one of the great things about listening to this record is how beautifully full it sounds. And, you know, we've been talking about, you know, obviously 3 albums tonight, but you know, for my money, the songs that you're going to find that will be listened to in years to come will come from this album, purely because the mastery of the instruments, the sense of musicians listening to each other, the fact that Alison Krauss, I mean, she rarely writes her own material. Instead, she, you know, listens to songs and then picks something, and it could be something that she's picked from 2000, 2005 and says now is the time to take this song and we're going to do it justice. And one of the things that's also very nice about their approach to bluegrass is that they try to incorporate subtle melodic aspects that feel very new and fresh in amongst very traditional arrangements, so that you get a sense sometimes that you're hearing both old and new within the same track. There are times when I find her vocal a tiny bit, I know this is a funny word to use in the context, but Disney, because she has a vocal that can go in a certain direction as a soprano. She has a very beautiful vocal, but there are times when it's not as gritty as I might perhaps like, you know, like a Lucinda Williams type vibe. But this is quite the record.
So she is with Union Station, and her usual co-singer is not with her this time. It's somebody called Russell Moore. And I want to introduce the Hangman song, which is a terrific song. Just set that one up for us,
yeah.
Nadine.
So Russell Moore is from the band Third Time Out, and you know, he has such a mournful vocal, and this track really, really showcases it just beautifully.
Yes, some wonderful storytelling on this.
And we wondered we had the time.
That's The Hangman from Arcadia, and that was Russell Moore on vocals. Obviously, Union Station is Alison Krauss's band. That's such an evocative song there, Pat. And I think it talks about the hangman coming to town and then he's trying to recruit another hangman. What do you think of Russell Moore's involvement in the band?
I think his voice is fantastic as a kind of a foil for Alison Krauss. There's not a huge difference, to my ears anyway, between his voice and the voice of the other man you mentioned, Dan Tominski.
Tominski, yes.
Yeah, I mean, people will know his voice. It's when George Clooney Clooney opens his mouth and, oh brother, where art thou? It's Dan Tominski's voice that comes out of him. It's kind of a similar voice, and it's great when I like the way the album is divided up between the two of them. I think Alison Krauss's voice, though, is an incredible instrument. There are parts on this album, like the first song, Looks Like the End of the Road, when she jumps into the chorus, it's just beautiful. And it's like Nadine was saying, that the whole thing really is beautifully put together. The players are just fantastic. There is that sparseness, but it doesn't feel like that. I mean, the only criticism I'd have is maybe, you know, with previous Union Station albums, there was more maybe a mix between upbeat and downbeat stuff. This is quite downbeat, this album, but in a beautiful way. I mean, it really is a lovely record.
We should listen to some Alison Krauss. This is Looks Like the End of the Road, as Pat has suggested.
Tears from the heart and a fear that when I look around, I lost what I found when I started off. Never thought I'd cross.
There's Alison Krauss there from her album Arcadia. Stars from you out of five, Nadine?
Four.
Four out of five. And from you, Pat?
Yeah, the same. Very strong 4 out of 5. Great record.
Thank you very much. That's Pat Carty and Nadine O'Regan listening to our albums this evening.